You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
Welcome to Nobody Told Me. I'm Laura Owens.
And I'm Jan Black. Exercise is the closest thing there is to a magic bullet for healthy aging. So says our guest on this episode, investigative health journalist Judy Foreman, author of the new book, Exercise is Medicine: How Physical Activity Boosts Health and Slows Aging.
Judy says it's not just the passage of time that makes our bodies fall apart as we get older. It's lack of exercise. And we can't wait to talk about this with you, Judy. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Talk to us about why you became interested in the link between exercise and aging and how the book came about.
Well, I've been a science writer professionally my whole life. I've been a science writer at the Globe and then a nationally syndicated health columnist at the Globe and a whole bunch of other papers. So I've always had a tropism for science, but I've also been an exerciser my whole life, and kind of the two strands came together a few years ago. Like everybody else, I already knew exercise is good for you, but the science writer in me really wanted to know exactly why at the deep molecular cellular level, and I found out.
So explain more about that, why you say exercise is medicine.
It's medicine because it's not a drug, we should say, but it acts all over the body. The body is a very tightly interconnected system. Bone tissue talks chemically to muscle tissue, which talks chemically to bone tissue. Muscles make chemicals, make little hormones that go act elsewhere in the body to control inflammation. You know, the brain makes chemicals that talk to various parts of the brain. It's all, you know, there's a multitude of things that happen when you exercise. And to me, that was just fascinating. So I started investigating it.
In the book, you talk a lot about aging, because I think that's why so many of us are so interested in exercise, because we're trying to look the best we can and fight off time as much as we can. But what was so interesting to me was how you talk about not everybody aging in the same way. So is aging inevitable, or can we manipulate it?
I don't think we can totally get rid of it, but aging in the whole animal kingdom on the planet, some creatures don't age at all. In other words, they don't deteriorate over time, and their risk of dying is the same as like an hour after they're born to, you know, 10 years after they're born, whereas for us, the risk of dying goes up as we age, and we do see the essence of aging, which is essentially the depressing deterioration of every body part over time. But the good news of the book is the scientists have discovered nine basic processes that constitute aging, and exercise can kind of roll back or slow down each one of these nine things. On the other hand, sitting around too much, a sedentary life, and eating too much can actually make these nine hallmark processes go faster. So it's really it's a direct line from exercise to less of these factors that control aging.
And along those lines, I know one chapter of your book is called Sitting Kills. Tell us more about that, about the dangers, because you don't really think, well, I'm just sitting around. You don't think it's dangerous.
I know. I mean, there's a sort of a joke, but it's not a joke. Sitting is the new smoking. I mean, sitting too much is so bad. I mean, when I started research for this book, I thought that a sedentary lifestyle was just the low end of the activity scale, you know, like the opposite of marathoners or something. But it turns out it's a whole separate category of badness. It's a huge risk factor just in and of itself. There's a lot of reasons for that, but one of the main ones is kind of intuitive. When we sit too much, We tend to put on weight, and we gain fat. Well, you can sort of pinch some of it in your stomach, but there's a lot of fat that you can't pinch that's kind of deeper in your belly, and it surrounds a lot of the vital organs. And it used to be thought that fat was just kind of an inert blob of white gooey stuff. But it turns out that fat is a very active endocrine organ, which means it pumps out hormones. And among the hormones it pumps out are little things called cytokines, or in the case specifically of this, adipokines. And these hormones basically stimulate inflammation all over the body, chronic inflammation. And inflammation is the underlying cause for so many of the diseases of aging, including diabetes and heart disease and neurodegenerative problems. So you can kind of trace a direct line from sitting too much fat, too many cytokines, too much inflammation, too much disease, too much diabetes, obesity, et cetera.
Did you find that...
Pretty strong case.
Oh,
yeah,
my gosh.
Yeah, really,
yeah,
really.
Yeah, absolutely. Did you find that exercise tends to play a bigger role in our health and aging more so than diet?
Wow, that's a good one. I'm going to go out... Well, I can't go out on a too big limb. Obesity is a huge problem. Mm-hmm. And you can't control it. Theoretically, you can control it by exercise, because bottom line is calories in, calories out. So if you really burned, 20,000 calories a day and didn't change your diet and you hadn't been doing that before, you'd probably lose weight. But for most of us, the math is just against us. Like if you're a 160-pound man and you walk 3 miles in an hour, you burn 255 calories, and that's the number of calories in a small muffin. So you're doomed if you try to do it just by exercise, because we don't burn as many calories as we think we do.
Mm-hmm.
So that is a problem. But exercise does so many different good things for the body that even a moderate amount of exercise can lower your chance by about 33% of cardiovascular disease and by about the same percent of all-cause mortality. It's a huge good drug, if you want to put it that way. It's a very effective intervention.
So what is the basic exercise recommendation for adults and also for kids?
For kids, I'm not sure, but I think it's almost double for adults, which is tough because a lot of schools in the recent years have cut back on phys ed programs, which is really the wrong thing to do. But for adults, the government recommendations are 150 minutes a week of moderate intensity exercise. So if you translate that, 150 minutes comes out to 30 minutes a day for 5 days, which is pretty doable for most people.
Mm-hmm.
And moderate activity means doing whatever you're doing, walking, running, swimming, whatever, at a pace where you can talk a bit, but you can't sing. In other words, you're a little bit out of breath, but you're not so out of breath you're gasping. But if I could add on to that a little bit, the 30 minutes a day for 5 days, first of all, that's a minimum. But the good news is you don't have to do the whole 30 minutes in a row. You can break it up into even 5 or 10 minute segments just so you're moving. And even though that may seem like a lot of time to people, it's not that much time. There was a recent story in the New York Times about a study of more than 30,000 American adults, and it was called a time use study. And they asked people how they spent their time, and then they took away the time that they didn't have any control over, like work and taking care of the kids and getting dinner and doing the laundry and all those things. And pretty much everybody still had 4.5 or 5 hours a day where they could choose how they wanted to spend their time. So the problem actually isn't so much that people don't have enough time to get this, 30 minutes a day in. It's that they perceive that they don't have the time because they've allocated that time to TV or something else.
If people do just the bare minimum amount of exercise, like you said, how much could they expect to increase their life expectancy?
By about 3 years. which is not nothing, but
yeah.
almost more important than extending the length of your life is extending what researchers call the health span. In other words, the number of years you spend healthy. The idea, to put it in slightly jargony language, is they call it squaring the curve. That means if imagine a curve of our lifespan. There's sort of a long, slow, rounded line down where we gradually get more and more disabilities and illnesses, and then we die. But what squaring the curve means is we kind of keep a straight horizontal line along the top without all these diseases piling up. Stay healthy for a really long time, longer than otherwise, and then drop dead suddenly. But without what they call a lot of sickness, morbidity. The other term for this is compression of morbidity. You squeeze all the bad stuff into the very end of life instead of having 10 or more years, you know, where you're just piling up the diseases. And that's the big thing that exercise can do, is increase the health span and also the lifespan. But the health span is almost more important for most people.
If exercise is good for you, why do we often feel sore after we do it?
Well, there's something called, inelegantly called DOMS, delayed onset muscle soreness. And actually, that's more of a puzzle than you think. Scientists don't exactly know what's happening with that. It may be related to the good kind of inflammation that occurs after you've used your muscles a lot. But that inflammation is not the harmful kind. That doesn't keep going on day after day after day. That's kind of a time-limited thing. And if you're sore, that probably means you haven't used those muscles. You sort of suddenly use those muscles a little bit more than they're used to. So you can back off and then, you know, gradually build up again.
I really enjoyed reading about what exercises you think are most beneficial. And I agree with you about high intensity interval training. And I was wondering if you could explain that a little bit to our listeners who may not be familiar with it and why you think it has such great benefits.
Yeah, it's called HIIT, H-I-I-T, High Intensity Interval Training. And it kind of got discovered or first researched in Israel way back in the 70s. And the protocol that they invented then, you know, the protocols for how to do this you can find on the web or in my book, and they vary all over the place. But the original protocol was 30 seconds, so not that long a time, 30 seconds of really maximal effort. I mean, you are really cranking it. And then 3 or 4 minutes of recovery, which can mean walking slowly or sometimes even just standing there catching your breath. And then you go back and forth 3 or 4 times during the course of a workout, and you do that workout multiple times a week. The idea is to work really, really hard and then let your heart rate get down and, you know, you sort of recover, and then you do it again several times. What I do is sort of a made up my own thing. I do 1 minute pretty fast on the treadmill, and then I do 1 minute slow, and I go back and forth and back and forth for half an hour, which is actually a fair amount of time. But you can do it. There are books out there, including one by a really good exercise guy at McMaster University in Canada. His name is Martin Gibala, G-I-B-A-L-A. And I think it's called the 1 minute workout or the 1 minute exercise. That's a little extreme on the little end, but a lot of people get big benefits from high intensity exercise for a 10 or 20 minute span. So you don't necessarily at all have to spend, you know, an hour on the treadmill or an hour running or even an hour walking. You can just alternate fast walking and slow walking.
So do we have to run to be physically fit, or does simple walking do just as much good?
In general, running is probably better, but walking, especially if you walk at a brisk pace, can be fine, and it's a whole lot easier on your knees. I mean, a lot of people used to be runners in their youth, and then their knees kind of conk out, and they have to switch to biking or swimming or walking fast. But you can get just as good a workout doing other things besides running. The key is to get your heart rate up there. You can go, if you have a gym, you can go to an elliptical machine or an exercise bike or obviously a real bike. I'm a swimmer, so I get a lot of my exercise by swimming. Basically, the idea is to work out as hard as you can, you know, alternating hard and slow, or fast and slow. And it doesn't have to be running. It doesn't have to be running. Oh, that is kind of the queen of exercise. And it's certainly the most studied of all the exercises.
Throughout the book, you talk about all these great inspirational stories of many, many athletes, some of whom are in their late 80s or 90s. And I know you at least had one that was over 100 who have accomplished.
Yeah, the French guy.
Yes, exactly. And they've all accomplished these incredible athletic feats that I couldn't do. And I know a lot of our listeners couldn't do as well. What was your favorite story?
Oh, that's easy. I mean, but just for your listeners' concern, I mean, I'm a kind of fanatic too on this, but even I don't want to aspire to some of these huge feats that people do. But the reason I put them in is, though, for inspiration and also to show that the human body can do these things. Not that we have to, and not that we even necessarily want to be a superstar in our 80s and 90s, but it is possible. Mm-hmm. My favorite story is the 85-year-old woman, Catherine Byers, who's terrific. She has a great life story. And she ran the Boston Marathon, which is one of the tougher marathons because we have a few really killer hills. And she ran the marathon a couple years ago in 7 hours and 50 minutes, 5:00 minutes. I think she was the oldest person in the entire marathon. And then she spent the night in a hotel in Boston and got on a plane the next day and went to France and did like a 5-week hiking trip. And she says, you know, she plays bridge with much younger people in the evening, and she's lively and full of life and not falling apart, and they're conking out by a little after playing bridge for an hour or so. I mean, there's people who really, you know, it's a big boost to your life to be able to feel that good, even in later years.
I know one of the interesting things in your book is the fact that replacing just 2 minutes of sitting every hour with a bit of moving around helps mitigate the risks of sitting. And in fact, you also say don't sit for more than 30 minutes at a stretch. Tell us a little bit about that, because I wouldn't think that 2 minutes would really do that much.
Yeah, you know, I wouldn't either. That's a really good question. I mean, one of the more depressing studies that I read, most of the studies I read were not depressing at all, but one really was, and it was a study from 2014. They had almost 250,000 American adults, and they were really good exercisers. They exercised 7 hours a week, so that translates to an hour a day. And in a good week, I almost do that myself. But if those same people sat for 7 hours a day, like straight sitting at your desk or watching TV, you still have a lot of cardiovascular risk. If you just sit straight for all those hours, you lose a lot of the benefits of the exercise. So, yeah, the recommendation is to get up every half an hour, every hour, and even just stand, or if you're watching TV, walk around the sofa or go get up and get a cup of coffee or go to the bathroom or, you know, do a load of laundry or something. In fact, you can, if you have a Fitbit or a phone with a certain exercise app, you can program the thing so it buzzes you every hour and says, yep, time to walk another 250 steps. And it's kind of stupid and silly, but it works. Those little reminders, you can set your phone to remind you every hour. And it really helps. It's so simple and basic, and yet it really works.
Mm-hmm. What role do genetics play on aging versus the environment?
Ah, well, it's not versus. Both genes and the environment contribute a lot to how long we live, to the average or maximal lifespan. If you're born into a safe environment, your chances for longer life increase dramatically, because when you think about it, if the environment is safe, then the babies can live to childhood and then adolescence and then reproductive age, and then after that, if they're lucky, they can keep going. If your environment is unsafe, you may not survive past being born. And prey will get you in the animal kingdom, and in human life, things like viruses and bacteria can be very detrimental to babies, which is one reason why childhood vaccinations have essentially made the environment so much safer for modern kids that they can live longer. And there's a lot of evidence that the lifespan has been getting longer. Women are actually having their first baby a couple years later in life than they did just a few years ago, all of which is a good thing, although I have to say the life expectancy in the last two or three years overall has been going down because our environment has been getting less safe. People are dying a lot from opioid overdoses and from what they call diseases of despair, like suicide and gun violence. But, you know, overall, for the planet as a whole, the environment has been getting much safer, not through the miracles of modern medicine, but through really basic things like refrigeration that keeps food from spoiling, cleaner water, stuff like that, that just allows us and other animals to, you know, survive childhood and survive adolescence and keep going after that.
I noticed that you pointed out that at the molecular level, we don't all age at the same rate. And you also note that different organs and tissues in the same person age at different rates. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah. Isn't that wild?
Yeah.
Well, there's this thing called the epigenetic clock, which your listeners may have heard of. Epigenetics, just for the record, refers to changes that happen to the DNA, but not in the DNA itself. Changes in the DNA itself are called mutations, and we all sort of think we know about that. Epigenetics refers to things from the outside that act on the DNA, and what they do is they tell a certain gene to turn on or turn off. And it turns out that one of the big things that controls all this is a little chemical glob called a methyl group, M-E-T-H-Y-L, if you remember your high school chemistry. And what happens is these methyl groups land on various spots in the DNA, and it's called DNA methylation. And basically, the more of it you have, the older you are molecularly. There was a fantastic study in Sweden a few years ago where they asked a bunch of young men, I mean, basically healthy young guys, and they did muscle biopsies. They took a little bit of muscle tissue from both their legs and they on each of the guys, and then they had them all ride bikes in the lab several times a week for like 45 minutes at a time and keep that up for a number of months, 3 or 4 months. And then they did another round of muscle biopsies. But the really cool thing they did was they made the guys only use one leg to exercise. And the other leg, the foot was just, they stuck their foot on the floor and it did nothing. And the fascinating thing was the leg that got the exercise had a totally different pattern of DNA methylation than the leg that didn't get exercise. And sort of in terms of the epigenetic clock, the leg that got exercise was physiologically younger than the leg that didn't get exercise.
Oh,
it's
wow.
Really cool. It's a cool experiment because it's obviously like the perfect control group. It's the same body, same food, same sleep, same life, except one leg got exercise and the other didn't.
You found out some really interesting information, too, about the purpose of living beyond our reproductive age. I've always wondered why that is.
Well, so has everybody else.
I'm glad we do, but just saying.
You're not alone. I mean, there is no purpose to it in the sense that evolution doesn't plan anything. Evolution doesn't say, oh, I think it'd be really good to make it so that people live past the reproductive age. What happens is that it's happened sort of semi by accident, but it turns out to have a very useful effect. What it's called the grandmother effect in shorthand. And basically having a lot of post-reproductive females around is a huge resource for children and the grandchildren and their ultimately their children. Because if you can help your grandkids survive among animals, you know, if you know where scarce food is in a time of scarcity, or if you know where old water holes are, if you're an elephant or a whale or some of these other species that have grandmothers, you know, post-reproductive females, that knowledge of where the watering holes are or the extra food, that can help your kids and their kids survive, which ultimately means that your genes, which get passed down the line, are also surviving. So there's an advantage all along the line to having grandmothers around. And grandfathers, too, can be really important. Back in 1993, I was a reporter for the Boston Globe, and I went out to New Mexico to cover what mistakenly had been called the Navajo flu, but it turned out to be an epidemic of what was called the Hanta virus, H-A-N-T-A. And a lot of people, Navajo people, were coming down with this. And it was a deadly disease. People were dying of really bad pneumonia. And the New Mexico health authorities teamed up with those from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, and they all put their heads together, and they were not getting anywhere figuring out what was going on, why all these people were getting this lethal pneumonia. And they had the good sense to talk to the Navajo elders, who I think were mostly the grandfathers, not the grandmothers. But in any case, the elders said to the doctors, you know, we noticed something like this twice before in the 20th century. There'd be a lot of excess rainfall and snow melt, which led to a super abundance of pinon nuts, which led to a huge abundance of deer mice that fed on the nuts. And this huge population of deer mice led to a big output of deer mouse poop, which eventually dried and got aerosolized, and then the people breathed it and got these lung infections. So it was the knowledge of the Navajo elders that really cracked this mystery for the doctors, the modern doctors. Again, a very useful thing for having older people around.
Why do men age faster than women?
That's a good question, and I'm not sure why. What we do know is that their epigenetic clock shows that they do, and also different ethnic groups age at different rates according to the epigenetic clock. And as you mentioned, some organs in the body age at different rates. You know, like the heart can actually be biologically 50 and the lungs 30, or the other way around. It's probably ultimately a function of the DNA methylation, but why that happens to men more than women, I don't know, and I'm not sure anybody actually knows.
I've been really open on the show about how I've struggled with depression, and I find more than anything that exercising helps me feel better. And I loved reading about your research that showed that that was indeed right, that exercise does have a lot of benefits cognitively. What are the stats like? Are fitter people really less likely to develop depression, and does it help them prevent Alzheimer's and other cognitive issues?
Yeah, you actually, it's sort of two separate but connected issues. There's exercise and cognition, which is actually one chapter in my book, and exercise and mood, which is another chapter. Cognition is, I'm sure your listeners know, is that kind of the thinking stuff our brain does, making decisions, analyzing things, memory, all those functions. And mood, obviously, is how depressed or underpressed or happy or sad or anxious or whatever that we feel. Excuse me. The really cool thing that I learned during the research of this is that the same brain chemicals are involved in both. It turns out that when you exercise, your brain pumps out a chemical that scientists call by a nickname Miracle Grow, like the stuff you put on your plants to help them grow. The technical name for Miracle Grow is BDNF, which stands for brain-derived neurotrophic factor. And that just means, brain-derived means it comes from the brain, it's made in the brain, and neurotrophic means it's aimed toward nerves. And what happens when you exercise, your brain pumps out this BDNF, and it goes to the hippocampus, which is the memory center, one of the memory centers for the brain, and it literally makes new brain cells go. It's called hippocampal biogenesis. Not that you have to remember that term, but basically, this Miracle-Gro makes new nerves grow in the hippocampus. And it turns out in terms of mood that BDNF seems to work in tandem with another chemical that the brain makes called serotonin. That's the chemical that if you take Prozac increases the availability of serotonin in the brain. But it turns out that BDNF works with serotonin. So BDNF really is this miracle thing that boosts cognition and mood. And the evidence is overwhelming. I mean, it's just amazing. The the scientists in the Ontario Brain Institute in Canada came up with a study that showed if everyone who is currently not exercising started exercising, we could eliminate one in every seven cases of Alzheimer's. That's huge. In terms of depression, a lot of the studies show that exercise is a very good way to help prevent depression, and if you already have it, it's as effective as the medications in a lot of the cases. I mean, obviously, if you have depression and you think you need medication, you should certainly talk to your doctor. But a lot of people are able to control it themselves just with exercise.
And Judy, on every episode, we ask our guests, what is your nobody told me lesson? So what do you wish that someone had told you about exercise or aging that would have saved you from some lessons that you had to learn the hard way?
Nobody told me that I could be as fit now or even fitter than I was, say, 30 years ago. I just had a birthday yesterday. I'm 76. I had no idea that I could be as strong as I am now. And a week ago Sunday, I participated in this swimming marathon, and I swam for 3 hours and 20 minutes and swam almost 6 miles, 5.7 miles. If you had told me at age 40 that I would be doing that at 76, I would not have believed you. And I'm thrilled to find out that older people can be really fit. And it's a blessing. It's wonderful.
Well, happy birthday.
Thank you.
And thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure, and good luck to both of you.
Our thanks to Judy Foreman, whose latest book is called Exercise is Medicine, How Physical Activity Boosts Health and Slows Aging. It's published by Oxford University Press, and her website is judyforeman.com. I'm Jan Black.
And I'm Laura Owens.
You're listening to Nobody Told Me. Thank you so much for joining us.